just landed in jail. Look out, boys, they come down fast. Baby addiction of the wicked class. In your heart or in your home, never have to be alone. Woman doors and wild attack, anything to catch a man.
You are tuned into Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Welcome to another edition of Stark Raven. Stark Raven takes a closer look at prisons and the politics of criminalization, and we are here the first three Mondays of each month from 7 till 8 p.m. My name is Emily Aspinwall, and welcome to the Prison Justice Day radio special. Prison Justice Day is August 10th each year. It is a day to remember people who have died unnatural deaths behind bars and raise awareness around conditions inside prisons. On today's show, we'll be looking at the history of Prison Justice Day, hearing prisoners' writings, and finding out more about this year's Prison Justice Day events. We're also looking at the issue of mandatory minimum sentencing, drug laws, and what the Tories are up to with their tough on crime agenda. Later in the show, we have ticket giveaways. We have two ticket giveaways. One's to an upcoming out-on-screen film, and another one's to a Billy Bragg show on September 29th. And we're also going to be hearing music on today's show from the new Mecha Normal CD, some Tycho from Loud, and music from Lal. So we'll be back in just a moment with our interview on mandatory minimums. This spring, Canada's Minister of Justice, Vic Taves, introduced two bills as part of the Tories' Tough on Crime agenda. One of the bills, Bill C-10, proposes to place mandatory minimum sentences on various gun crimes. The Tories had originally wanted to include drug crimes as part of this bill, but dropped that part of the bill as they figured it wouldn't pass in the Parliament if it was included. The Tories have stated that they hope to introduce a separate bill introducing mandatory minimums for drug laws in the near future. Canada already has mandatory minimum sentences on almost 40 different crimes under the Criminal Code. Concerned advocates from across the country and from a wide range of groups have expressed grave concern about the increased use of mandatory minimums, and particularly mandatory minimums for drug laws. Here to talk to us more about mandatory minimums and drug laws is Joanne Chetta. She's the executive director of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. Thanks for joining us, Joanne.
Thank you, Emily, and thanks for highlighting the issues of prison justice.
Can you start by telling us more about mandatory minimums? What are they, and how did they work?
Mandatory minimums are pretty much what they sound like. They take away discretion about sentencing from judges who, under Canadian law, have a lot of discretion for certain categories of crimes. And they pretty much lay out in the law that for certain crimes, there has to be a certain minimum amount of time served in prison. So they're really the antithesis of things like house arrest or, you know, electronic bracelet kinds of so-called conditional sentencing. And they take us way far away from any kind of effort to find alternatives to prison for those crimes that are affected by the law.
And what is the Tory government's claim with mandatory minimums? What do they claim they're going to achieve with this?
Well, in the analysis that is in the bill that was put forward by the Harper government, there is the suggestion that so-called conditional sentences or house arrest type penalties have been overused in Canada and have been overused especially for serious crime. But as you suggested, this is really the best example you could possibly think of a policy that's meant to help politicians look tough on crime, but really is not based on good rational evidence.
So that was my next question. Is there any evidence that mandatory minimums achieve their goals? And if not, why go down this road?
Yeah, especially for drug crimes. It's amazing that you don't often have a kind of a natural experiment having already played itself out so vividly as this one has in the United States, where there have been several periods in U.S. history where mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes, including relatively minor crimes, have been applied. And that's happening currently in the U.S., although some of the 50 states are trying to find more alternatives to prison. But basically, you have this experience in the United States that has shown that this policy has filled prisons across the country with people who have committed nonviolent drug-related crimes. It has set back rehabilitation, obviously, because rehabilitation in prisons in the U.S., as it would be here in Canada, is a very limited matter. And it has especially caught in its net smaller-scale offenders. And why is that? Because, the discretion on sentencing gets taken out of the hands of judges who are impartial, at least in theory, and it puts it into the hands of prosecutors who can then make deals based on information and other things that people can trade. And it's rare that the smaller scale offenders will have access to the kind of information that would allow them to trade for a better deal from the prosecutor. So the bigger guys get off. They always have ways to protect themselves, and the small scale dealers, the nonviolent, often first time offenders in the U.S., have swelled the ranks of people in prison, including, I should add, many, many, many women. There's been an 800% increase in the incarceration of women for drug crimes in the period of this last period of mandatory minimums for drug crimes in the U.S. And again, that's because women either don't want to trade against the man that they may be with, or they don't have the kind of information that would help them to get a good deal. So this policy has failed in every possible way. In the U.S., drugs are more plentiful than ever. We know that this has not made a dent in drug crimes, but it's made a lot of politicians look like they're tough on crime.
So you were mentioning a little bit there about how mandatory minimums magnify some systemic discrimination and systemic problems in the criminal justice system. Can you comment a little bit more on how you see that playing a role in the introduction of mandatory minimums?
Well, it's a little bit hard to say, but it's clear that if the whole system is driven by how many arrests can be made and how many people can be thrown behind bars, you have a real you give law enforcement officials a real incentive to engage in all kinds of practices that they might not otherwise if the goal were rehabilitation or helping people to find access to the health services they need. So in the U.S., a lot of analysts would say that the mandatory minimums have really gone hand in hand with practices like racial profiling, because there is the sense that it may be easier to get a conviction on an African American or on a Hispanic American. In any case, and as I say, the whole matter of women and their role in drug crimes, often an accessory role, nonetheless has landed them with long sentences in many cases. It's a system that has perverse results. It's based on no good evidence. And in fact, the Ministry of Justice in Canada studied the matter under the former government and did a really good analysis of what the U.S. experience has been and said that, at least for drug crimes, this just doesn't make sense.
So some people say that we need to target the dealers of drugs and that maybe mandatory minimums will do this. Can you tell us a little bit about what the impact is in terms of dealers and drug users?
Well, there too, the U.S. experience has been illustrative. It's nice to think that you could just target in a clean way the dealers and leave the smaller users alone with these laws. But in fact, these laws rarely make that kind of distinction. And what you have in any drug scene in North America is that sometimes people will sell a small amount of drugs just to be able to maintain their own addiction, and those people would be treated under these laws unless the law were very, very different from the U.S. law, which is hard to imagine, but these people would be treated pretty much the same as someone who's kind of a full-time, larger-scale trafficker. So, in fact, these laws also have the tendency to make that distinction between dealers and users a very fine line indeed.
And what about what's going on in terms of drugs and drug use behind bars now and sort of maybe foreseeing via looking at the states or into the future in Canada if mandatory minimums were introduced for drug laws? How would that affect the relationship between those on the inside using drugs and the availability of drugs? Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I think it's a frightening prospect, and this is a little bit why an organization like mine, which is focused on HIV/AIDS-related human rights and legal questions, has gotten into this discussion. You have denial right now in Canada that there are drugs in prison, and specifically that there is injection of drugs in prison, whereas we know that that happens, and we know that people are injecting with pretty much any sharp object they can find sometimes, and hepatitis C and HIV both are spreading in prison at a rate that's many times faster than that of people outside prison. Now, as long as you have that kind of denial informing the policy, that means that Canada, unlike a number of Western European countries, unlike a number of even former Soviet countries, unlike Iran, if you can believe it, will not even think about having programs in prison where sterile syringes are provided. This means that if you're going to be throwing drug users, and in many cases people who inject drugs, into prison at a high rate, you're just going to be feeding this horrible health crisis that's happening with bloodborne diseases behind bars because there is no access to sterile syringes, which, you know, every excuse in the world has been found, but these programs have existed for years and years now in many countries. Needles have never been used as a weapon in countries like Switzerland, Spain, even Kyrgyzstan, even now, as I say, Iran. And actually, in places like Switzerland and Spain, where these programs have been around for a long time, the biggest advocates are the prison guards, the prison staff, because they know if they do a pat-down search, it's much less likely than it was before the syringe programs were there that they would be pricked by a contaminated syringe. So, again, instead of helping the public to understand these things, the correctional services at the federal level, anyway, has not listened to the Public Health Service, which has been trying to push the idea of at least a pilot syringe program, and instead is continuing to say that there isn't drug injection in the prisons, and that's just crazy.
Because the rates of HIV and hepatitis C inside prison continues to increase. Is that not the case?
Yes, and there too it would be nice if correctional services at the federal level would allow independent researchers to go in and study this, but we do have some smaller scale studies from around the country that indicate that HIV prevalence is probably at least 12 to 20 times higher than in the non-incarcerated population in many institutions in the country. Hepatitis C probably even worse. And, you know, there's huge costs associated with that, to say nothing of the legal and human rights issues.
And that was my next question. What about money and fiscal costs in terms of mandatory minimums and this type of approach to dealing with drug use?
Well, it's hard to see how it makes any kind of fiscal sense. Incarceration, as we know, is a hugely expensive proposition. Canada could get a much bigger bang for its buck by investing in drug rehabilitation and treatment programs. We in our organization hear from organizations of drug users and methadone users all the time. We hear that there's methadone waiting lists in many parts of the country. People don't have good access to services that could really help them stabilize their lives. Methadone has a great track record, including in Canada, where it is available. And we know that people can really turn themselves around when they have access to those basic proven health services that are extremely cost-effective. They can be productive. They can hold jobs. Instead, spending tens and tens of thousands per person per year on incarceration and putting people into a situation where they're likely to contract a disease unless they're extremely careful and have access to syringes through some under the table source. And what do we know? I mean, we know that treating one case of hepatitis C in Canada costs on the order of $150,000 per person. HIV, much harder, much more expensive, much more long-term treatment. So how do these things make sense even economically? I don't know.
So what can we learn from the experiences of mandatory minimums in other parts of the world? I know you've mentioned a lot the United States, and that is definitely one case. But I know there are some places in the world that have been retreating from the use of mandatory minimums. Is there anywhere else that you wanted to highlight in terms of experiences that they've had with mandatory minimums?
There's no place that I know that has had as sustained an experience with mandatory minimums with respect to drug offenses. There are places, countries that have used them for longer periods with respect to guns, which, as you mentioned early on, is part of Bill C-10. I think the U.S. is certainly the most illustrative case because it's been such a sustained policy. And I think that, in fact, even in the U.S., as I said, there are some states where people are looking more at drug courts, looking more at other kinds of alternatives to incarceration. And even in some states, the prison guards are beginning to come around on this because they see the disastrous consequences behind bars of this policy, to say nothing of the fact that prisons are absolutely way beyond their maximum holding limits in many parts of the U.S.
And you've mentioned a few alternatives or different ways of looking at drugs in terms of harm reduction and needle exchanges and other such things. Do you have any other comments on what are some alternative ways in which we need to deal with the effects of drugs in our communities?
Well, I'd like to just say that to me this policy is a little bit of a piece with the Harper government's refusal to pronounce itself on Insight, the supervised injection facility in Vancouver, where you are. How could Insight not be seen as good public policy by the people in Ottawa? It's a little hard to know when peer-reviewed published research over and over has shown the excellent impact of this, including for things, you know, for people who have abstinence in their mind all the time when they make public policy. There's even evidence from Insight, from the supervised injection facility, that you know, the people who are using it are more likely to be able to talk to somebody about rehabilitation services, about getting treatment for their addiction. What could be better? And yet we have this, you know, this dithering that's been going on in spite of the city, the business community, the experts from all over the world, weighing in on this question. So I hope that Minister Clements, as well as Prime Minister Harper himself will begin to see the light on this question. To me, again, this is, you know, the knee-jerk reaction of treating drug addiction, even for nonviolent small-scale users, as a crime, treating it with the blunt instruments of criminal law, rather than looking at the health services that are out there, people's real access to them, people's real access to counseling and support, which we know have better track records, which we know are cost-effective, which we know are much more in sync with the idea that drug users have rights to health services. So the whole picture really concerns me, because once the law is there and law enforcement people feel empowered to make even more repressive kinds of applications of criminal law for people who use drugs, who really, really could be much better served by public health programs, then you really worry about a kind of a public policy slippery slope, and I hope that Canada will be smart enough not to go down that road.
So speaking of that road, where to from here? I mean, we're in the midst of Bill C-10. I think it's in the Justice Committee now, and that's mandatory minimums for gun crimes. The
right.
Tories haven't yet introduced mandatory minimums for drug laws. Do you know anything else about what their plans are, or what people can do if they're concerned, and what it's looking like this fall, the fall sitting of the legislature?
Well, I think that Bill C-9 is very relevant to drugs, even if it's not as explicit as it might be about categories of drug crimes, because Bill C-9 is looking to dismantle this system of what I called before conditional sentencing, things like house arrest, alternatives to long-term incarceration. And we're concerned about Bill C-9 in that regard, so I think people should be talking to their parliamentarians about Bill C-9 and how that might, in fact, be applied in cases of nonviolent drug offenses. It's not clear to me that that's completely that's not pertinent in this case. If there is in fact another bill, there would certainly be it would be important to be talking to parliamentarians about this, and I think especially to be looking at the evidence that's out there. We tried to capture some of the U.S. experience, including the Department of Justice's own analysis, in a paper that we wrote that people can find at www.aidslaw.ca. But there's lots of other things out there, and people might, Canadian taxpayers, in fact, might be interested in looking at the Ministry of Justice study, which was paid for by their tax dollars and is a very good study, and that's on the Ministry of Justice website.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today. I know you're on holiday there in California, and really appreciate taking time out to talk about this issue.
It's really my pleasure, Emily, and good luck with all your Prison Justice Day activities.
Thanks very much.
No problem.
We have been speaking with Joanne Chetta about mandatory minimums and drug laws. Joanne's the executive director of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network, and as she mentioned, there is more information on their website. It's www.aidslaw.ca, and you can also find more information on mandatory minimums at prisonjustice.ca. We're going to go now to a song by Mecca Normal, oh dear, off their new album, The Observer, and this track is called The Message. You're listening to Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7 FM, and this is Stark Raven.
Along with Stephen Lewis, the dancers are dancing towards.
Yes, that is some new Mecha Normal, the local group with David Lester and Gene Smith. And most of the album is about Gene Smith's experience internet dating. So it's quite funny. And you can find more information at their website, mecha_normal.tripod.com. And this is off the Kill Rock Stars label. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. This is Stark Raven. Prison Justice Day is August 10th each year. It is a day prisoners have set aside as a day to fast and refuse to work, in a show of solidarity to remember those who've died behind bars unnecessarily. This happens while outside organizers work to raise awareness around prison conditions. Next, we hear an excerpt from a Prison Justice Day documentary produced last year in honor of the 30th anniversary of Prison Justice Day. In this excerpt, you'll start by hearing Tiffany Chong introducing some archival audio of prison abolitionist Claire Colhane talking about the history of Prison Justice Day.
But the story of Prison Justice Day begins with one prisoner, Eddie Nalin. In 1974, Eddie died in Kingston's Millhaven Maximum Security Prison. Claire Colhane was instrumental in supporting Prison Justice Day right from its inception. She spent the last 20 years of her life fighting for prisoners' rights. Claire was interviewed on Vancouver Co-op Radio in 1993. Here she is describing what happened to Eddie Nalin as he waited for release from solitary confinement.
At that time, they would have a review every week and be told whether they were going to come out. Every week passed and he still wasn't released. And finally, he gave up and slashed himself. And it turned out, ironically, that he had been released that week, but they forgot to tell him. But the most important thing was that each cell was supposed to have what they called a panic button, because it was really a dungeon and nobody would ever hear them banging on the door. He pressed the panic button, but the guards had cut the wires so they needn't be bothered seeing the lights flashing, and he died. He was this is Eddie Nalin. He was very well loved, and prisoners took it very badly. And Howie Brown, a prisoner actually from Vancouver, who was in the next cell, wrote to me, and he said the following year they were going to hold August 10th as an anniversary and declare it Prison Justice Day. The prisoners would do a 24-hour fast and a work stoppage, and they hoped that outside we would identify with that. I should add that at the inquest for Eddie Nalin, the recommendation was made by the coroner that the wiring had to be repaired and kept functional. However, less than 10 months later, Bobby Landers, another well-known prisoner, had a heart attack in the hole. And guess what? The panic button still wasn't working. So he was the second death within the 1 year.
At the time of these deaths, prisoners were becoming increasingly frustrated with the system. Abuses towards prisoners ran rampant. Little was being done to remedy the problems. Eddie Rouse is a lifer who remembers the atmosphere in the mid-1970s.
There has been abuses across Canada at that time. The penitentiary system, under the guise of the and being controlled by the Prison Guards Union, were very strong at that time. Basically, didn't seem to be responding to any kind of inquiries, whether or not they be public or government inquiries. And there was a lot of whitewashing that was going on at the time.
In June of 1976, two prisoners named Jack McNeil and Howard Brown sent out this letter.
To all prisoners and concerned peoples from across Canada. On August 10, 1976, the prisoners of Millhaven Maximum Security Prison will stage a one-day hunger strike in remembrance of our two fallen comrades, Edward Nalin and Robert Landers, who died in Millhaven Segregation Solitary Confinement on August 10, 1974 and May 21, 1976, respectively. And in remembrance of our fellow comrades and brothers and sisters from prisons across the country who died in the hands of an apathetic prison system and its people. Furthermore, is a protest against the Millhaven administration, the Canadian Penitentiary Service, and the members of the Parliament for their continued indifference to the recommendation of the inquest jury made at the inquest into Edward Nayland's death. The recommendations concerned emergency first aid procedure, medical and psychiatric treatment for solitary confinement prisoners, and that the emergency signal systems in the cells and the time clock, which assures regularity and range of patrols, be made functional and that steps be taken to provide that they remain functional. None of these recommendations were enacted by the above-mentioned authorities. We protest against the continuous inhumane use of solitary confinement, segregation, and the repeated whitewashing of spineless individuals in the government who are forever having inquiries into the use of solitary and its effects on a person's mental and physical state, and then hide the real facts of its use from the people. We call upon our brothers and sisters from all prisons across the country and upon all concerned peoples of Canada to give their support to our one-day hunger strike in remembrance of our comrades and to unite as one voice in our struggle for better understanding, compassion, and equal justice for all. Jack McNeil and Howard Brown for the prisoners of Millhaven.
Prisoners across the country responded to this call, not only to remember Eddie and Bobby, but also to protest similar injustices throughout the system. By August of 1976, prisoners across Canada were taking part in Prison Justice Day. Eddie Rouse was in the BC Penitentiary at the time, where nearly 500 prisoners participated.
I remember the first August 10th Prison Justice Day when I was at the BC Pen, and the guards didn't know exactly what to expect, and they were under orders to keep the peace by whatever means possible. At the BC Pen, it was really strange because you had a strong mixture of people. There was a unification of everybody in there, where everybody acted as one. It wasn't just a scattered protest. Everybody was informed on what this was about, and they adhered to it. They all made sure that they wanted to know what it was about, and they all respected it, because everybody knew somebody who had been harmed in the system and or because of the system. And they themselves may have been harmed. Now they've started with the recognition of prison rights or prisoners' rights, as it was not only on the outside, but it had to carry that education inside too. What ended up happening, it was just a peaceful day of protest. Nobody went to work. Nobody ate. Everybody fasted for 24 hours. Also, nobody spoke. And it was a prisoner's sort of remembrance day for everybody, except there was 24 hours of silence. What happened, the only time people got out of their cells for that day, they went down and they picked up the meals and then they threw the meals into the garbage. So the prison staff would not be able to reuse that and feed the prisoners the next day the same food. The only other time that they went out is when people got their medications. At that time, we were, you always get certain sanctions if you don't obey the prison rules. And one of the sanctions was losing a remission or good time. And for everybody, they lost one day of good time for not working. They were also charged for wasting food. So they had to go to warden's court for that. So everybody who threw their meals into the garbage, and that only happened for the first 150, and then the guards went around asking everybody if they were going to eat, and when they said no, they didn't let them out. So the only a couple of hundred people got charged with wasting food, but everybody lost a day of good time. The idea of remission had no impact on anybody doing a life sentence. It would have an impact if it was somebody who was doing a fairly short period of time, 5 years or under, because if they keep losing remission, it would have an impact on their release date.
That was Eddie Rouse talking about Prison Justice Day in BC Pen in the mid-1970s. You're listening to Stark Raven on Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7 FM. We are doing a Prison Justice Day radio special, and Prison Justice Day is August 10th, and it's a day each year that's set aside to remember people who have died inside prisons. We're going to go now to a sound by Loud, and Loud is a local band who've played many Prison Justice Day concerts in the local women's prison. They also appeared this past weekend as part of the Powell Street Festival. This track is called Johnny Bear. It's off their album Tycho Electric, and the song is in memory of a woman who died in prison. You're listening to a Prison Justice Day radio special here on Stark Raven on Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7 FM. And that was some Loud, the track Johnny Bear off of their album Tycho Electric. And the song's in memory of a woman who died in prison. Next, we're going to hear two readings by prisoners. The first reading is read by Rachel and is titled Prison Justice Day. And the one following that is read by Tasha and is titled Folding My Hand.
Prison Justice Day, hanging at the end of a noose, a guillotine cutting the head loose, stretched on the medieval rack, 40 lashes to the back, pelted with numerous rocks, stuffed in a suffocating box, removing lobes from the brain, prisoners made to go insane, readily doled, justice was swift and cold, dished out by governments, unimaginable punishments, punishments that no longer exist, created by attitudes that still persist, attitudes calling for swift retribution, claiming it's the only solution. Pressing hard, attitudes trying to weaken our guard, hoping society will forget the horror prisoners once met. Grumbling in the air, scripted to scare, hoping to let loose the hangman and his noose. A frightful vision, add your voice to the decision. Stop, reflect and pray, then speak out on Prison Justice Day.
Folding My Hand by a Prisoner on Parole. One evening, back in the day, we were playing cards. It's a common pastime in prison. There's a small excitement about winning and losing that can be stimulating at times. In the middle of our game, in between hands, a man came walking into the room to tell us that it would be a good idea to get ready for a lockdown. Why? Someone asked casually. There's a body stuffed under the couch over on another unit, the man said. They probably won't find him until count time, though. Well, we have time to play a few more hands, then, another man said. And so the game went on. Death that night was a casual distraction. Often in prison, the life and death struggle isn't recognized with the appropriate respect. Indifference and disregard run rampantly hand in hand through those places. All too often, there's no concern for how or why a man's life ended, or for the pain left behind. But even though that man's death was accepted so callously by those surrounding him, who's to say that there were not others who received the news grievously or mournfully? Who's to say that there was no one to cry for him? Looking back from where I am now, I accept the news, somewhat painfully, and so I'm grateful today that someone chose to recognize the tragedy of dying in prison, that someone chose to mark the tragedy by fasting one day in memorial of those who suffered such a sad, lonely fate. August 10th is Prisoner Justice Day. It's an important day for everyone. For convicts, it's Remembrance Day. For the relatives of those who died, it's a Memorial Day. For the authorities who assume the responsibility of implementing corrective or rehabilitative measures, it is hopefully a day that raises their awareness about the need to adjust a system that malfunctions. With the responsibility those authorities assumed comes the necessity for those to be some special concern paid to how life is lived behind bars. The cold, hard places they sometimes are require intervention. There is a need for further involvement. Human beings cannot be subjected to alienation, isolation, and degradation. The deaths inside prison are the result of a hate-filled environment that is unable to flourish. Adjustments need to be made. More opportunity for positive growth needs to be offered to those who have strayed from the good way. Only then can we even begin to give hope that death in prison will come to an end. For myself, August 10th is another chance to pay my respect to life. Having come out of those places, having found my way down a healing path, I have grown to see what is important to give attention to those things that I've done wrong. One evening, back in the day, I was playing cards, just killing time, when death struck just over there. I received the news indifferently, callously, and disrespectfully. Since then, I've seen many Prisoner Justice Days roll by, and I have fasted every time. But only lately have I grown to realize how sad and necessary this day is. This August 10th, I'm folding my hand and getting up from the card table. I'm going to bow my head and fast for those who are unable to ever come out of those prisons. I'll say a prayer for change so that these things don't happen again. I'll respect the day and remember those that suffer the injustice of tragedy. And I'll support those good people who take action against the way life is depreciated in prison. I am grateful to my Creator for having brought me away from those places safely. However, I will always be mindful of where I have been. I will not forget how important even a small justice is to those cons still doing their time. I pray for their safety.
And that was Folding My Hand. It was a piece written by a prisoner, and it was read by Tasha. And the piece before that was called Prison Justice Day. It was also written by a prisoner, and it was read by Rachel. You're listening to Stark Raven on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, and this is a Prison Justice Day radio special. Prison Justice Day is on August 10th each year, and it is a day to remember those who've died inside prisons of unnatural deaths. And there's a number of events happening for Prison Justice Day, and there is a memorial rally happening in Vancouver this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. It's at the Claire Culhane Memorial Bench. That's in the southeast part of Trout Lake Park, or John Hendry Park, in East Vancouver, Victoria and 15th. And it's near the snack bar on the large break playground. Everybody's welcome, rain or shine, and there's going to be a number of speakers, including Eddie Rouse, who you heard from earlier in the show, Carlene Faith, the BCPWA Prison Outreach Program, known as Illegal Justice for Girls, Strength and Sisterhood, and Cece Weiss will be doing a Coast Salish welcome. Next week on Stark Raven, we're going to be featuring highlights from that Prison Justice Day rally. So be sure to tune in next Monday, August 14th at 7 p.m. For those rally highlights. And if you want more information on the history or any of these events, you can go to prisonjustice.ca. And we're going to go now to a song by Lal. This is off their album Warm Belly High Power, and this track is called Orange. And Lal is performing at the Prison Justice Day rally in Toronto this year, and that rally is happening this Thursday, August 10th, outside the Don Jail in Toronto. You are listening to some LAL, and they are from Toronto, and they are again performing at the Prison Justice Day rally in Toronto this Thursday. It's outside the Don Jail there, and that's their album Warm Belly, High Power, and the track Orange. We're going to go now and hear a performance poem by Rita Wong. She's a local activist and author, and she performed this poem at the 2003 Prison Justice Day Memorial Rally held here in Vancouver.
Before we cross the threshold of this ragged, brutal place called prison, my skin always tightens and our eyebrows raise in ironic response against the mechanical voice that intones control. Our bodies walk in, but our hearts refuse to accept prison's pretense of order. Through rules, regulations, rigid schedules, body counts, lockups, isolation, segregation, monitored, mind-numbing control. Its technology of surveillance betrays a desperate ignorance, willful anesthesia. No amount of bleach can disguise the iron smell of blood in the building, the slow deaths and sudden suicides that are institutional murders. Women's souls hover around the prison. Women who have taken their lives out of the maximum security equation. Women who refuse the obscene economy of the prison industrial complex. Women who left the concrete walls of the incarcerating machine through death. Women who remind us to work, to fight for the living, to love them with all of our might. We reject the systemic murder made anonymous through prisons. We stand here together in the necessity for solidarity with our sisters, our brothers, our friends, our comrades, our allies who are inside. The abused, the poor, the hungry, the angry, the dysfunctionalized, the pathologized, the criminalized, the dreamers, the migrants, the refugees, the anarchists, the poets, the rebels, the beaten, the bruised, the fragile, the unlucky, the targeted, the lost, the beautiful, the daring, the sad, the lonely. Who is inside? The despairing, the wounded, the angels, the avenging spirits, the mothers, the abandoned, the addicted, the lesbians, the colonized, the warriors, the peacemakers. These are some of the souls behind the cement and the bars. Deserving of love, of memory, of care. Embodying society's failure to understand its own humanity and interconnectedness. Reminding us of human weakness, human strength, the need for tenderness. Since the potential for immense kindness and immense cruelty runs within each and every one of us. The trapped, the terrified, the inspired, the simmering, the gentle, the violent, the artists, the specially talented, all souls hover and gather together, broken, hurting, courageous, stubbornly hopeful, we continue together.
And that was Rita Wong performing at a Prison Justice Day Memorial Rally in 2003. Rita is a local activist and author. You're listening to a Prison Justice Day special here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. This is Stark Raven. We are here the first 3 Mondays of each month from 7 till 8 p.m. And we take a closer look at the issues of prisons and the politics of criminalization. So coming to this year's Out on Screen, that's Vancouver's Queer Film Festival, is a film looking at the situation for transsexual women inside men's prisons in the United States. The film is called Cruel and Unusual. It's aptly named after the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It's this Eighth Amendment that prohibits the infliction of cruel and unusual punishment on prisoners. The film details the disturbing experiences of transsexual women whose punishment could hardly be described as anything other than cruel and unusual when they are placed in men's prison. It follows the lives of several people over a period of 3 years. The women in the film tell of sexual abuse by guards and prisoners, denial of ongoing hormone treatment, and placement in psychologically damaging solitary confinement for what the system deems their own protection. It is estimated that 30% of transgendered Americans have been incarcerated. This is 3 times the national average in the United States. The film Cruel and Unusual explores how the poverty and marginalization that often results from discrimination creates this imbalance and looks at people working to change the situation. The film's directed by Janet Boss, Dan Hunt, and Reed Williams. And it's running as part of Out on Screen. The film is showing Wednesday, August 23rd at 5 p.m. at Tinseltown Cinemas. That's at Pender and Abbott. It's also being co-sponsored by the Vancouver Prison Justice Day Committee, and members of the committee will be there with more information about the situation for trans people in prisons in Canada. And Add-on screen's running from the 17th to the 27th of August, and we do have a pair of tickets to give away to a Co-op Radio member or someone willing to become a Co-op Radio member. So just give us a call in a couple moments, because we have to wait till we get off the air so we can answer the telephone. But it's 604-684-7561. We will be giving that pair of tickets away, so call us if you're interested in going to see that film. And thanks to Out on Screen for giving us those tickets. We do also have tickets to give away to the Billy Bragg Show. It's at the Commodore Ballroom on Friday, September 29th. And we have a pair of tickets to give away to that as well, so do give us a call at 604-684-7561, and please do call us in a couple moments when the music comes on, so then we can answer the phone. Yes, we are a small volunteer collective, so we can't do it all at once. Just wanted to announce that the Toronto Prisoners Justice Action Committee, they're the folks who are organizing events for Prison Justice Day in Toronto. They're looking for people to submit their films or videos for possible screening at the 3rd Annual Prison Justice Film Festival. That's happening February 8th to 11th next year, and it features film and video made by, for, and or about prisoners and prisoners' justice in Canada and internationally. So the deadline is October 13th, and there's no fee. You can see the full submission details for download at prisonjustice.ca. So again, the Prison Justice Day Memorial Rally is this Thursday, 6:30, Trout Lake Park in East Vancouver. Everyone is welcome, rain or shine. And again, you can tune in to hear rally highlights next Monday here on Stark Raven. In 2 weeks, we're going to be featuring talks from the recent Selling Security Forum that happened a couple weeks ago, organized by No One Is Illegal. And if you want more information on those Prison Justice Day events, check out prisonjustice.ca. So that's it for today's show. Thanks to Louise Croft for being our technical operator. And if you're interested in keeping in touch with Stark Raven, you can join our email list. Drop us an email at stark-raven@cooperadio.org. We'll tell you what's coming up on the shows and give you a digest of our news. And it's coming up next is Think Indian, followed by Pajvak and Blues in the Dark. So see you at Prison Justice Day. Have a good night.
You place the world on your shoulders and fight the good fight. Justice makes your heart pound and your fist shall always raise. Over and over, arrest me. It's how they get, yet they still can't bring you down. But I worry about you, I worry about you, I do. I can tell something's on your mind by that blue look in your brown eyes. I can tell something's on your mind by that blue look in your brown eyes. You breathe in the gas, they're force feeding you to bring the system down, down, down. Countless times they try yet not manage to break the underground. Over and over.
something's on your mind by that blue look in your eyes.